Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Don and Dude.
Hey, hosers. It's the Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Don with me. Don, you ready to freeze your ass off and head north?
Yeah, just poured a bag of milk on my cereal.
Bag of milk. Nice.
Can I have some Reese peanut butter cups?
Hey, what's up? I mean, here, so obviously we're talking about Canada. What's up with people in America sometimes saying Reese's instead of Reese's?
I hate that. I don't know.
I don't hate it exactly, but
But it's Reese's. It's Reese apostrophe S. Yes. Reese's Pieces.
Yes, I've heard it like many times, and I've asked people, like, I don't know, it's just the way I learned it. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
That sidetrack was fun. This is the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums, the album format, and we've got a great show for you today. We are officially ending our summer road trip, as we called it, Bands Across America. This week, Bands Across North America, so we can include our neighbors to the north.
We've traveled many kilometers.
Yes. So we are headed to Canada, and each of us will be presenting an album by a Canadian artist or band. Then, as always, Don's going to ask us a deep question. Wonder what we'll talk about. We'll also have some shout-outs to some albums and album-related items we're digging, you know, new releases, that kind of thing. And then we'll fill y'all in on what we're doing on the next episode, a very special episode of the Album Nerds Podcast. But this week, we're headed to Canada.
Road trip! That's what I'm talking about!
Welcome to Canada, the Great White North, where cultures converge and creativity soars from coast to coast. From the heartbeat of Indigenous drums and the lively reels of French-Canadian fiddle to the poetic folk of Quebec's, I'm going to try this, chansonniers.
Nice.
And the rock anthems that echo from Toronto and Vancouver. Canada's musical spirit is as vast as its landscape. Explore vibrant cities like Montreal and Vancouver, marvel at the wild beauty of the Rockies and the Maritimes, and discover the warmth and diversity that make Canadian culture truly unforgettable.
I'm telling you, Canada owes you some money for that beautiful presentation. So Canada, the Europe of North America. I mean, it is a different country, and it is,
yeah.
And it's funny how it feels like it.
Yeah.
Which is great. Plenty of artists to choose from, more than we're going to list out, but we'll hit some highlights. Now, from a personal perspective, I'd like to mention One Bad Son. They're like a hard rock band. Sheepdogs, they're kind of like a almost southern rock boogie band. Those are the big two that I follow, but just want to shout out to them. But of course, Neil Young, folk rock from Toronto. Mm-hmm. Joni Mitchell, queen of folk. Celine Dion, Franche, sings about Titanics. The hip hop world, Drake, who I've struggled to get into. Hasn't worked out for me and Drake.
Your team, Kendrick?
I guess I would be, yes. Rush, progressive rock band, Gordon Lightfoot, more folk, Shania Twain, big country pop superstar, Mr. Michael Bublé, channeling Sinatra and Harry Connick Jr. all at once, Alanis Morissette, who we've talked about, the Tragically Hip, probably the biggest Canadian rock band just in Canada for the most part, Arcade Fire, we've talked about on the show, Sarah McLachlan, Justin Bieber, The Band, The Weeknd, Nickelback, who we've talked about on the show, Bare Naked Ladies that I'm trying to avoid talking about on the show. Avril Lavigne, K.D. Lang, and
it's a long list.
It's a very long list. And we had to pick only two, and we did it. So we've got the albums queued up, the tank is full, and Canada is ahead of us. Let's roll out with our cha-cha-cha choices.
You choose me?
And our first stop in Canada takes us to 1967 with the debut album from Leonard Cohen called Songs of Leonard Cohen. Leonard Cohen is a Montreal-born poet, novelist, and singer-songwriter. Yeah, he had a lot of literary roots kind of before his music career launched.
Quick question. Had Leonard Cohen been writing for other people prior to this? And this is those songs that now he's presenting as himself.
Yeah, there are a few songs that appeared elsewhere before this album was finally made.
Okay.
He originally had aspirations more in the Nashville country music realm, but he became fascinated by the folk scene of the 60s, or the folk revival, I should say. Well, let's get right into it. Here's the opening song, Suzanne.
Tea and oranges that come all the way from China, and just when you mean to tell her that you have no.
All right, wake up, everyone. Don's about to talk.
So, before I was made familiar with this album a few years ago, the Leonard Cohen I knew had a very deep and gravelly voice. And this is not him, so it was quite a shock to me.
Me too.
Yeah. But anyway, so Suzanne originated as a poem that Cohen had written in a book called Parasites of Heaven, supposedly inspired by a friend named Suzanne. I guess it was just a platonic relationship. I've always liked the imagery of it. I can kind of picture it like hanging out on a boat or on the water with some interesting girl, like a hippie chick or something that, you know, has like strange things and, you know, just kind of, yeah, like an artsy girl or something.
Yeah. We talked about this song before, right?
I can't remember if this was on that Judy Collins album. I remember there were Leonard Cohen songs on that. Oh, you know, this might have come up on the Roberta Flack album.
I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I'm like the tea and the oranges. And I'm like, this is familiar stuff. So
it's kind of weird. And I guess it's true for a lot of this album. You know, he goes off on some tangents because the first verse is basically describing Suzanne and his interactions with her. Then the second verse is suddenly about Jesus and being a sailor and all that stuff. And then the third verse is back to Suzanne.
He seems to confuse romantic feelings and longing with spiritual transcendence, or maybe there's a parallel there. Yeah, Jesus walks on the water, and then it's paralleled with Suzanne's Riverside tea.
Yeah.
You know, he's kind of announcing he's not a typical folk singer. He's kind of mixing the sacred and sensual.
Hmm.
Maybe it is or isn't your cup of tea and oranges. I don't know.
And it, you know, so it's mostly sparse arrangements. You know, this one has some backup singers in there that add to it. Well, John Simon is the producer for this album, and I guess Cohen and Simon butted heads a little bit. So Cohen preferred a more sparse arrangements, and Simon, you know, wanted to introduce more, you know, embellishments, you know, other instruments and backup vocals.
Thank you, Simon.
Yeah.
This would have been, I mean, it was kind of sleepy as it was without those sort of, I don't want to quite say Burt Bacharach, but kind of Bacharach light feeling there does help keep your lids from closing all the way.
Yeah. And I think a good balance is struck because it still just feels like it's Leonard Cohen singing to you, though, you know? So I think all that other stuff doesn't distract from the song.
No.
Okay, well, let's hear another one. This is the Stranger song.
Like any dealer, he was watching for the card that is so high and wild, he'll never need to deal another. He was just some Joseph.
There's more religious stuff thrown in there.
I do like that line, some Joseph looking for a manger. I don't really know what it means, but it does strike chords. I think that's the point of using religious imagery, which we've talked about on many of the albums we've discussed recently, where there's religious mentions and overtones. It's because it, for so many people, it makes them go, huh?
Yep. So the Stranger song, you know, kind of deals with themes of transience and rootlessness. And so I think that's maybe the Joseph looking for a manger, right? Like trying to find
a purpose.
And a shelter. Yeah. So some see it as Cohen describing himself as a stranger who can't stay like in love or in love's warmth. But others see it more as a woman who's constantly providing shelter for men who end up using her. Mm-hmm. So you could look at it different ways.
Yeah, I saw it as just the restlessness of mankind.
Yeah.
That circular guitar work does enhance the trancey feel of it. Makes it feel intimate, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's right. And speaking of his guitar, I think unlike other folk musicians of the time, it's more like Spanish style guitar.
A little bit, yeah.
Supposedly he had learned it from a Spanish immigrant in Montreal. But yeah, you know, kind of a classic Spanish style guitar in a lot of these songs, which is interesting. I do like the line, you know, the like any dealer, he was looking for a card that was so high and wild he'd never have to deal another.
Yeah.
You know, he's got lots of little cool things like that.
It all seems kind of disjointed, which I guess is what poetry can do sometimes. So this is less song structure than a lot of other, true. Even folk artists. Although folk artists do have the freedom to play around more, I think, with song structure.
Yeah, he's definitely more wild than, say, Gordon Lightfoot, who I think is generally more straightforward and structured. And
he's as wild as he could ever be and never be another.
Good, I like that. All right, well, was there a cut you wanted to highlight?
Yes. Kind of a little break. This one is as light, I guess, as it gets and as positive as it gets. It's called Sisters of Mercy.
And they brought me their comfort, and later they brought me this song.
This one was written in a hotel room in Edmonton during a snowstorm after Cohen spent the night with two young women, but platonically.
Huh. A lot of platonic.
I think it's more of a humble brag here. And nothing happened because I didn't want it to happen.
No, I watched them sleep and wrote a song about them.
Yeah, that's not creepy. It's hymn-like, and there's sort of this gratitude for human kindness, and then the gentle female backing vocals kind of add to that texture. I guess this is embodying generosity and empathy for each other. Do you know, like, the story here, like, more about the story?
No, I mean, I think it was basically he just shared a room with these girls and, you know, was, I don't know, kind of inspired by them. You know, I mean, I guess they were cool chicks.
Okay. Now, did you? I didn't hear that line in there anywhere. These were cool chicks, really, really groovy. Did you hear some accordion and, like, little bells in there? Is that what that was? Because I liked that. I liked a little texture because, again, these are very trancey, sleepy songs. Yeah. There's not a lot of celebration of life on this planet. It's more about survival, it seems.
Yeah, it makes sense. And they're all kind of connected, though. So, I mean, if you're a person who's, you know, rambling around or kind of lost, then you find refuge with, you know, with the Sisters of Mercy.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, there's that. Sisters of Mercy sounds like nuns. We get a little, you know, back to the religious undercurrent. And Judy Collins did make this song popular. She was kind of the more radio-friendly front for a lot of Leonard Cohen songs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that is true. All right, let's discuss the closing track. This is One of Us Cannot Be Wrong.
I lit a thin green candle to make you jealous of me.
I've done that so many times, lighting thin candles to make people jealous. What's that all about?
I'm not sure the significance of the candle. That one I didn't figure out. But, you know, I think it does seem to be kind of a romantic obsession song. Like, not just him, but he talks about some Eskimo who, you know, also was obsessed with her, and then some other therapist or something, or a professor or something that was obsessed with this person. It's almost like there's something about Mary, I think.
Oh, man.
There's just something about Mary.
I love Mary, man.
But then, I mean, the song ends in the strangest way. Just these guttural, or not guttural, but wailing.
It's wailing. It's not quite like what I'd read it described as falsetto, but it's not falsetto.
No.
It's raw. It's almost shocking compared to the calm and the sort of detachment.
Yeah.
That's what's weird about this is it's all about these super emotional things of being alone and feeling comfort and whatever, but it's kind of like old Catholic mass, especially in the Latin, where everything is kind of said like this when they're saying, you know, the priests are doing this thing. It's kind of like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I got the same kind of sleepy vibes as I used to during Mass when I was a kid. Like, is it communion time yet? Because that means at least people are going to move around a little.
All right, well, this is a good time to rewind and reflect on songs of Leonard Cohen. Now, I've heard there were some special songs that Leonard Cohen wrote, and it pleased an album nerd.
Oh, hallelujah. Okay, wow.
Yeah, so, of course, Hallelujah was... You know, one of Leonard Cohen's most famous songs.
Co-opted by Jeff Buckley. There's no going back once that version came out.
Yeah, so this, I like this collection of songs. I like the darkness of it and the vulnerability of it. And I really like this voice of Leonard Cohen. It has a brightness to it that you don't have later in his career. And I think that maybe makes it a little easier to, you know, to take in or to process. It's better than him, you know, like if he was singing it that way, I think these songs would just make you, you know, want to end it all.
Yeah, perhaps.
But I mean, I think his songwriting is really interesting, and I've done a lot of homework with it. Like I ended up looking up a bunch of these songs, like what the hell is this about? Right. And sometimes it's, you know, it goes pretty deep. So I mean, that's fun if you're into that kind of thing.
Yeah, if it's a big if. All right, so I'll describe the album in my clickbait headline. From Montreal to the world, Leonard Cohen's debut was like emotional maple syrup, sweet, dark, and best served with a side of melancholy.
Mm.
It's intimate, poetic, reflective. His voice is sparse. The instrumentation kind of highlights the lyrics, I think. We're talking about love and longing and all that stuff. No arena rock energy here, that's for damn sure. It's slow and purposeful. It's meditative. It's almost prayerful, but not much fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's fun watching strange ladies sleep. But other than that,
Yeah, I think the fun is maybe sometimes just the clever wordplay.
Yeah, but you really, you've got to pay such close attention to get to any of it. Otherwise, it's just kind of na-na-na-na-na for however long this album is.
Yeah. All right. Well, Killer to Filler Ratio. I mean, I think it's a consistent album.
Yep.
And there are a couple of poppier moments. I would say So Long, Mary Ann is probably the most accessible tune. And then also Hey, That's No Way to Say Goodbye kind of feels almost like a duet, even though it's just him. But there's some really effective, you know, backing vocals on there. And then one track I wanted to highlight was Master Song. That's one that also, I mean, it seems like it's about a love triangle, but I've read that it's actually about like Judaism kind of responding to like Christianity, and you know, the way that they're serving the master is different. So yeah, it gets pretty heavy.
Yeah.
Did you have any favorites or not least favorites?
I mean, sometimes most of it felt like filler. I don't know how long this was, but it felt very long.
It was 40, something, low 40s, I think.
That's it? God.
Yeah.
I mean, not that it's not artistic and awesome for what it is, but sometimes it's hard to differentiate because the songs are all pretty similar sounding. It's really about the lyrics. Hey, That's No Way to Say Goodbye is gentle, but it's kind of overshadowed by So Long, Mary Ann. I feel like they were in the same lane. Yeah, and
they're back to back on the album.
Yeah. Stories of the Street was too surreal and dense, especially upon first time listening. It's like I felt like you really needed to do literary deep diving there and figure out what the hell's going on.
Yep.
And I don't like doing that much work. I have a hard time focusing on albums like this.
You'll do the work for Mastodon, but not for Leonard Cohen.
Well, Mastodon has some juice. It's got some flavors, you know? It's not one soundy.
Yeah. I hear you. We've talked about the production already quite a bit, but John Simon, as I mentioned, he had worked with the band and Janis Joplin before, and there was kind of, I think there was a tug of war between Cohen and Simon.
I'm glad.
Yeah, I think it worked out.
Yeah, this would have been even harder to focus on.
Yeah, I do like the intimacy of the album. I think it sounds great.
It's to the point of discomfort at times, though. It's like he's making audio eye contact. You know, like just won't break the eye contact. And it's like,
that's true.
My shoulders were up quite a bit during this album. What about replayability? Is this, I know this is something you've grown up being interested in.
I didn't grow up with it, but I think somebody let me borrow it, you know, 15 years ago or something. And I've kind of lived with the album since.
You've done growing up since then.
Yeah, that's true. I have. So yeah, I listen to it, you know, pretty often. I kind of inspired by the lyrics of it, and yeah, I think it's a well executed album. But so I'm getting the sense that maybe you won't be listening to it a lot.
I mean, not a lot, but I mean, I feel it's weird because normally I'm all about full album, listen to the whole thing, suffer through the songs you don't like as much, and keep going. But I'd say it's best savored in pieces, not full blasts. So I'd probably revisit some of the songs maybe, and then maybe listen to other versions of those songs by other artists to sort of like soak it all up. But that's just me.
And the legacy, well, I mean, there's a bunch of songs here that have been covered by other artists. So I think this confirms, you know, Cohen as a songwriter,
mm-hmm, for sure,
and, you know, not just a poet. I'm not sure where he fits in the folk realm, you know, like compared to Dylan. Of course, both of them kind of moved on from folk. And then, I mean, I assume Leonard Cohen probably influenced other, you know, Canadian artists like a Gordon Lightfoot.
Even Joni Mitchell and Neil Young.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, with its stark beauty and poetic depth, Songs of Leonard Cohen endures as both an intimate confession and a timeless cornerstone of modern songwriting. Check it out.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
It's time again for Deep Questions by Don. All right, so we're going deep into the heart of Canada. What are some cool things from Canada?
Hey. So I'm going to start off with some food.
Me want food!
I do want food. Poutine, a Canadian dish, I guess from Quebec originally. It's French fries, cheese curds, and brown gravy, traditionally. And it sounds gross the first time I heard about it, but it's good. The saltiness of the cheese curds and mm-hmm. crispiness of the fries. But I've been in Canada and had other versions of it where I had a butter chicken poutine one time.
Nice. So. I've been in places that offer vegetarian poutine, but I've never tried it.
You're missing out, my friend. I'm sure they can make some kale gravy that would knock your socks off. Additionally, I just want to mention Second City Television, SCTV, which was a Canadian television sketch comedy show where it pretended to be a fictional television station, sort of like a Saturday Night Live thing. Eventually, it did come to the States, but John Candy and Eugene Levy and Rick Moranis and Catherine O'Hara, Harold Ramis, Martin Short, all Dave Thomas, all came from that.
Yeah.
Some of my very favorite comedic actors and some great characters came from that. Like Ed Grimley, that Martin Short used to do.
I couldn't be more excited, I must say.
There was a cartoon show. Remember that? There was an Ed Grimley cartoon show. I think my little sister used to watch that. But anyway, thank you, Canada, for some really funny people that
definitely
kept us laughing. What about you, Donnie?
When I think of Canada, for some reason, I think of curling, although that wasn't invented in Canada. It was actually invented in Scotland and kind of brought over in the 1700s. But it is very much a Canadian thing.
Yep.
I think Canada dominates, you know, international competitions and stuff like that. For those that don't know what curling is, you're basically sliding these stones down the ice onto a bullseye.
But they're big. They're big and they have handles and stuff. It's not like pebbles.
Yeah. There is a curling club near me, and I have tried it a couple of times. It's a lot of fun.
What's with that? So the brooms that they do is that for friction or something?
So it's actually the ice is like pebbled, so there's a little texture to it, and so when you sweep away, it makes it smoother, so it makes it go faster or spin more.
What the hell they were doing? Like I knew that they were using little. I like watching it. I don't know anything about it, but
yeah, it's a fascinating game, and it seems very very Canadian. And then back to food. I'm not sure if it's reached everywhere in the United States, but Tim Hortons is pretty popular in our area. It's a coffee and donut chain, you know, named after the hockey star of the Toronto Maple Leafs, Tim Horton, who helped found the company from Hamilton, Ontario. I prefer Dunkin' coffee, but you know, Tim Hortons is a good second choice.
I think I would take Tim Hortons over Dunkin'.
You're nuttier than a Tim Hortons maple log.
All right. Well, what are your favorite things about Canada? Let us know on our social media, like Instagram and Facebook, at Album Nerds.
So I'm going to bring up the energy, maybe to a level of cheese, but that's okay. I'm going with Bryan Adams, who we did talk about this album Reckless years ago on the show, but wanted to revisit because it really has stuck with me over the years as a energy-filled arena rock celebration of life, which is kind of very different than what we just talked about. It's a fourth studio album by Canadian singer-songwriter Bryan Adams, released November 5th, 1984, coinciding with his 25th birthday. So Bryan Adams was born in Kingston, Ontario, and had also done a lot of songwriting for other artists, including a couple of Kiss songs off of their album Creatures of the Night, Rock and Roll Hell, and War Machine, if you ever want to check those out. And Bryan Adams did record those recently, his own versions. You can check those out on Spotify. Oh, one thing I should mention is Jim Vallance, co-writer on all these songs. They're songwriting partners like throughout Bryan Adams' career, which I appreciate that. I think especially, you know, the Bernie Taupin and Elton Johns, I'm not saying they're, you know, the same, but those kind of songwriting partnerships can be very fruitful because it's, you know, just like us here, Don, you know, working off of each other, throwing ideas out there and improving, like for instance, You Need to Sit Up Straighter, Terry, the show. This album, Reckless, produced by Adams and Bob Clearmountain, a big turning point in his career, big breakthrough success here. Sonically, it blends rock and arena rock, featuring driving riffs, powerful vocals, polished production, very typical of mid-80s FM radio rock. Much of the album explores the restless energy of youth and the emotional pull between carefree indulgence and their lasting connections. Why don't we kick it off with a little bit of the opening track, One Night Love Affair. That's what Leonard needed, a couple of yeahs in his song. So it really does set the tone pretty quickly of what we're in for here. It's got that crunchy Keith Scott guitar riff, big gated drums, no strings attached hookup, emphasizing the excitement and denial of temporary connections, fitting the kind of recklessness themes and chasing thrills of the album. It's got that Springsteen-esque mix of youthful lust and regret, but it's polished up into a more pure rock, and it's raspier too.
Yeah.
That was the fifth single off of the album. What were your thoughts on One Night Love Affair?
I think it's a great introduction to the album. Definitely has a stadium rock vibe to it, the drums. And I think a lot of it is because we recently discussed a Journey album, but I hear so much Journey in a lot of these tracks, yeah. And this is one of them. I like the lyrics a lot. Like I like the idea of, you know, a one night stand where two people are kind of pretending that they don't care more than they do.
Yeah.
So that's very cool. Oh, this song was featured in the film Real Genius, by the
way.
Oh,
yeah. Nice. Shout out to Val Kilmer. Rest in peace. All right. Let's jump into another song. This is my pick, is one of my favorites off the record. It's called Run to You. This is one of Adams' biggest hits. The riff is pretty memorable and iconic. It was the lead single off of the album. It's got that mid-80s arena rock polish. I think we're going to talk about that a lot throughout this record. Very crisp guitar riff, driving beat. But on the surface, it's like a classic rock love song. But the narrator admits that he has someone at home who treats him well. But when temptation comes around, he runs to the other woman, yep. Which I didn't catch as a little kid. I just thought it was about running to the one you love. I didn't understand that he's a Lothario. It's not sentimental. It's about lust and desire and moral conflict. There's that line, she's got a heart of gold. She'd never let me down, but you're the one that always turns me on. Just
yep.
What do you think of this one?
I guess I didn't think much of it back in the day. And I had this cassette when I was a kid, and you know, I loved this record. But I think probably in college, I remember I think I was under the influence of something, and I think I was in some situation where you probably don't want to be that way. And I remember like this song was on a radio or something, and it was like at that moment I just like when the end of the song really kicks in, yep. Where it's like din, 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 and that like whole ending part is just so like climactic, yeah. And I remember like being really moved by it, and it kind of like I was kind of in like tweak mode, and that took me out of it.
Wow.
So I've really grown to appreciate this song. I think it's probably my favorite on the album.
You don't hear a lot of stories. I mean, you hear people, oh, I was under the influence and listening to Pink Floyd or the Grateful Dead or whatever. I've never heard a Bryan Adams tale like that before. So appreciate that.
This song was actually rejected by Blue Oyster Cult and 38 Special.
Nice. Yeah. I'm glad of that, because I would hate for there to be other versions of this out there, because this is just the perfect delivery system for a song like that, that is a double agent sounding romantic, but it really isn't.
Yeah, it's cool.
All right, Don, so you being a longtime Bryan Adams aficionado, having the cassette, what song you want to talk about next?
I mean, there's so many options, but I figured we probably should talk about Summer of 69. I remember people back in the day sort of, criticizing it because, like, Bryan Adams would have been 9 in 1969. But supposedly Jim Vallance actually was 17 in 1969. So some of the autobiographical details are his.
Cool. That makes much more sense. I mean, I knew it was sort of just more painting a picture of whatever your summer of 69 is.
Right. Yeah, it really doesn't matter what year it is.
And it just sounds cool. I think in that period, Woodstock and 69 was a cool year. And then, of course, Bill and Ted it's their favorite number.
69, dudes!
So, it's pretty much a nostalgic song, with some romance in it as well. I mean, it sounds like he's singing to a love interest from that time.
Yeah.
But it also, I mean, right around the same time, we have Glory Days from Bruce Springsteen with a similar vibe.
More melancholy-ish to me in terms of just the way the storytelling lays out.
Yeah, that's true. It is very melancholy.
But yeah, this is probably the most Heartland rock song on the album. I mean, a lot of them touch on this stuff, but this is, this is, if this plays at a bar, everyone's singing, Yeah. It's just like Glory Days.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, even when you're, not as old as I am, I mean, you can be moved by, nostalgia and, thinking about your past and in your glory days.
Yeah.
So it's like a universal thing.
That pretty much starts as soon as college is over. or you're in your mid-20s or so and you're starting your career or whatever. Okay, well, why don't we close it out with the closing track, Ain't Gonna Cry. And looking for a good clip of this song, I never really paid super close attention to the lyrics, but catching that little line about I'm going to rearrange your face, I didn't know if it was a threat or if the person he's not going to cry over, they're crying and they need to fix their face, their makeup or whatever. But I was like, whoa, it's fast paced, high energy, almost punky tempo, almost. I feel like Brian's vocal delivery is a little rawer on this one. Like the shout singing is a little more aggressive. It closes the album on kind of a note of defiance, youthful bravado, I think, which ties back to the album's whole thing with the central themes of passion, restlessness, living fast, living loose. Kind of a hidden gem. I think it has some bar band roots, kind of feels like maybe 80s rock club where everyone's going crazy for this, not so much the arena stuff.
Yeah, it does have kind of a rootsier rock vibe than some of the other tracks. Yeah, I think it's an effective ending, and it does feel like a more aggressive side, to Bryan Adams. And I think that's nice because, we do get a lot of kind of softer romantic moments, earlier in the record. Yeah. So I think it's cool to end with some edge. Reminded me a little bit of The Replacements. Mm. This song and Kids Wanna Rock kind of have a Replacements vibe at times.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, well, having covered four illustrious tracks from this album, there's quite a bit more to talk about as we rewind and reflect on Reckless as a whole. For my overall vibe from the album, I'll kick it off with my clickbait headline. Bryan Adams turned up the volume on Heartland Rock. Reckless made stadium fans sing about running, heaven, needing somebody, and the best days of their lives. This is Bryan Adams at his peak. sleek, radio ready, full of youthful swagger, a mix of heart on the sleeve, rock anthems and tender ballads. And it perfectly captures that mid-80s energy when rock could go, you know, both tough and romantic. It didn't have to be one or the other. What are you thinking, Don?
Well, I'll give you my clickbait headline. Bryan Adams gets reckless with Journey's playbook. I think it's because we so recently did, you know, Journey Frontiers. But, you know, I hear so much Journey in this, particularly, I mean, the guitar playing. I mean, Keith Scott just sounds like Neil Schon so much on this record. And he's really good. I remember Keith Scott from the videos, but, you know, I didn't really know him by name. And, you know, he's, you know, quite a guitarist. And he really, you know, next to Bryan Adams, he's the, you know, I think the star of this show.
Yeah, I agree. Really good guitar work throughout. So as far as the rest of the songs go, there's so many to talk about. I mean, I feel like this album is stacked with killers. You know, we covered Run to You and Summer 69 and even One Night Love Affair, I think, are among those.
Yeah, we missed a couple of the singles. So, I mean, Heaven is like the ultimate power ballad. I mean, that one sounds... I mean, that's so Journey. You know, the Jonathan Cain-like piano at the beginning. I think I did read somewhere that because Bryan Adams had opened for Journey on the Frontiers tour, I think faithfully inspired him to write this song.
I think you're probably right. Although, I guess, wasn't there some movie it was meant to be in?
Oh, I don't know.
And they pulled it from that. I think he was hesitant to do this from what I read.
Mannequin? Just kidding.
What about It's Only Love with Tina Turner?
What a riff. It's, you know, I mean, that really shines on that song.
Yeah, I mean, at that time, there was this sort of, a lot of duets were happening, you know, Mick Jagger and David Bowie and Michael Jackson and Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder and Paul McCartney. There was just a lot of big name duets. And I feel like it wasn't so much a creative decision, but a commercial decision. And from what I read, Tina Turner was really big in Europe and Bryan Adams hadn't broken there yet. And this song was released there and helped to deliver him across the pond there, as they say. Yeah.
Then Somebody, we got to talk about as well. Sure. And that's, I mean, you could just, that one you can hear in a stadium. Yep. And there's even like the break in the middle with just the bass line. And that's like where he'd be saying, like, let me introduce you to my band. Yeah. On guitar, Keith Scott.
Yeah, I always really loved Somebody. The, hey, what about you? And all that. Just maybe it felt, you know, we keep comparing to Bruce Springsteen, but that sort of calling out to the crowd thing, it felt like he was yelling at the listeners, hey, or you know, or the people while playing live, the people out in the audience, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I need somebody like you. It just felt very connective somehow. But what about fillers? Anything that you just didn't like?
No, but it's hard when you have such big songs, you know, and such big hits. You know, songs like She's Only Happy When She's Dancing, or the, what's the bluesier one, Long Gone.
I like that, but yes.
I like them too, you know, but they just don't, you know, stand out.
Yeah, I agree. So production-wise, we haven't really talked too much about Bryan Adams and Bob Clearmountain working together on this. What'd you think about the production?
I think, I mean, I don't know, I guess maybe because I lived in this era, you know, it just sounds right to me.
Yes.
I think some people have kind of feel like Clearmountain maybe went a little overboard on the reverb and delay effects. But I mean, we've heard much worse,
yes.
I think, you know, from the 80s. So, no, I think it's good. It's Bryan Adams at his best, as his voice is in the forefront and it sounds powerful. The guitar is highlighted. I mean, it's, you know, it's perfect arena rock.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I feel like the 90s Bryan Adams with the Everything I Do It For You, and then the Three Musketeers, All For One and All For Love, kind of reframed him to some people as a Michael Bolton balladeer. I think people forget about, this isn't like sweet, you know, cool heavy metal, but it's harder edged pop rock, and the guitars have crunch. They don't overwhelm his gravelly voice. The drums are huge and echoing with that mid-80s stadium sound, which I think is very effective. And despite being such a radio-friendly record, it doesn't sound overproduced. There's still grit and sweat in the performances. Like I said, sometimes it evoked a picturing being in these venues where it might be playing. Replayability, big time. And it's short. It's 37 minutes. Yeah. So it's easy to play over and over again. It did not feel long like Mr. Cohen's.
Yeah. I mean, I listened to this album a lot this week, and it did get to the point where I'm like, oh, do I really want to listen to this again? But I think that's more just because I've been living with these songs,
yeah,
you know, for so long. But then once I, you know, would play it, I'd be happy. So, yeah, it's definitely one I can revisit.
Sweet. Legacy-wise, a cornerstone of Canadian rock history, it became the first Canadian album to sell over 1 million copies in Canada while also launching Adams to global stardom. It's a cultural export as iconic as maple syrup or hockey for me. And for fans everywhere, it's still the sound of like endless summer nights. I mean, it really depends on what area you grew up in. But if you grew up when this was at its peak, that's totally what I picture, you know, that my summer of 69. And that was, you know, probably in the 90s. But
yeah. And I think this kind of, you know, kept arena rock going. I think Bon Jovi sort of took the baton after this.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is such an important part of, I think, 80s pop, you know, is the sound.
So a Canadian classic of heartland grit and anthemic hooks, Reckless remains Bryan Adams' defining statement of youthful passion and rock ambition. Check it out.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Right, on your way back through the border, getting past Border Patrol, back into the United States. Did you have a chance to dig anything else?
Luckily, I do have my enhanced license, so I don't need
it. Yes, me too.
Yeah, I dug around a little bit and ran into a band I had not heard of, Basque. And the album is The Turning. They are from Asheville, North Carolina, formed in 2013. They play heavy Americana, blending psychedelic, stoner, and doom rock with Appalachian, depending on where you're from, influences. The band features Zeb Wright, Scott Middleton, Ray Worth, Jesse Van Note, and Jed Willis, who's new to the band for this album. He is a pedal steel player. Their music is known for heavy riffs, atmospheric sounds, and mountain-rooted storytelling. Let's listen to a little bit of Dig My Heels. There's that doom. The Turning was released August 22nd, 2025. It's a concept record about the writer, a young woman, and the traveler, an ageless gunslinger. Their journey explores immortality, family, aging, death, rebirth, the usual stuff in a concept album. Have you heard about this at all?
No, but I think I like it.
It's a pretty interesting album, and I kind of had Mastodon on the brain, so this was sort of a more Americana offshoot of that somehow.
Mm, yeah.
So speaking of that, the other album I want to talk about that I'm digging, with the loss of Brent Hinds from Mastodon and with us talking about their album Crack the Sky last week, I've been listening to a lot of Mastodon this week, and the first album that I became familiar with was their third, Blood Mountain, from 2006. Why don't we listen to a little bit of The Wolf is Loose? So, of course, I do have this one on vinyl. I have a blue see-through copy of it. I think it's from 2010 Record Store Day when I got it, but our former co-host Andy is the one that introduced me to Mastodon. I'd heard of them, but he talked me into listening to them, and Blood Mountain was the record. So that's where I kind of entered the fray. It's a concept album, of course, about a protagonist's quest for the crystal skull atop Blood Mountain, cursed to become a werewolf. So it was critically acclaimed. And Don, have you done your homework and listened to any Mastodon since we've last
time? I haven't really had a chance, but it is definitely on my list, okay. And I'm sure I'll get to all of them eventually.
Excellent. Get to it. All of you. What about you, Donny boy? What you digging on?
Well, I guess, you know, because we kind of did a dark crooner this week with Leonard Cohen, I found another one, somebody known as Panic Priest. His real name is Jack Armando from Chicago. He's got his fourth album called Once Wild. Here's a track called Little Lost.
That is very 1984.
Yeah.
I like it.
Definitely, you know, some new wave vibe there, some even some like disco in there. I haven't spent a lot of time with it, but you know, so far it's been pretty enjoyable.
It spins me right round, baby, yeah. Right round. Yeah.
And so one genre I've always kind of avoided is Christian rock. And so I heard about this artist here who kind of has, you know, sort of a darker kind of synth poppy vibe. His name is Don Beck. He has an album called Dark to Light. Here's a song called His Love Shines. It's kind of trippy sounding, I guess.
Yeah. Or, I wasn't sure what to expect.
Yeah, but you know, if you listen to the lyrics, it's definitely Christian.
Hey, I grew up with Christian rock and hip hop and stuff, at least on the periphery. So it's nothing shocking for me.
So what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky. And also, don't forget to dig on other great music podcasts like Can I Pod with Madness, where Jim, Mark, and Andrew dive into classic rock magazines page by page, unearthing wild stories and forgotten gems, from Iron Maiden retrospectives to 90s alt icons. It's Can I Pod with Madness, wherever you find podcasts.
I am making devil horns with my hand right now.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Here we are again. It's now time on the show when I'm reminded of the words of Michael J. Fox.
Alex P. Keaton.
Alex P. Keaton. And I quote, "I'm a Canadian. It's not just a nationality. It's a state of mind. Cool, calm, and kind." Perfect. With that in mind, let's talk about what we're going to be discovering next time, Don. What's the story? What are we up to? We're skipping the wheel.
Right. So we're going to have a special guest. Right. So I've mentioned this podcast before, the New Wave Music Podcast. We are going to have Steve from the New Wave Music Podcast join us, and he's going to help us define New Wave.
Interesting. And he'll pick the record, too.
All right. Well, what's your favorite record from Canada? What's your favorite new wave record? What else are you listening to? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com or follow us on Instagram and other social media at Album Nerds. And visit albumnerds.com to listen to all 305 episodes. And the best way to support the show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you once again for joining us on the Album Nerds podcast. We'll catch you next time, getting all new wavy.
Albums are all that I want, and they're spinning on my turntable. It isn't too hard to see, we are album nerds.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
Yeah.
One look in your eyes and...
No, we're done with that. Man, you've got to work harder on these, brother.
I know.
So that's why Brian Adams had a writing partner.
Yes, I need a Jim Valance.
Yeah, we'll work on these together for now. See y'all next time.